The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast October 29th, 2024. All right, good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked on this. Well, it should be a really gloomy, misty fall day since
it's
this
cloudy.
This is partly cloudy anyway. It's windy, too.
It is windy.
Yeah. And that other voice you heard is my guest, Uncle Gene. You want to be Uncle Gene? Also, El Tio?
El Tio.
El Tio, okay. El Tio is the host of Musica con Ganas, which you can hear on this station.
Sunday nights at 8 o'clock.
Sunday nights at 8 o'clock.
Also, Thursdays at 6.
Oh, yeah. And also, I don't know if you're not really a horror aficionado, are you, or are you? You've read more horror than I have.
I grew up, you know, watching the, we used to have our monster movies on Saturday afternoon matinees on TV. I mean, grew up with Werewolf and Dracula and all the classics. Mm-hmm. And, I kind of lost interest after, Friday the 13th and those Chainsaw Massacre movies, and it's like, that's more gore than I really need.
Yeah, I prefer stuff where it's hinted at, and you get
subtlety.
Yeah, and you get to be scared in your imagination instead of having it forced into your eyeballs.
Yeah.
Anyway, but as you probably ascertained, this is our Halloween show, and we have some recorded stories for Halloween and some that we can read live and just kind of whatever. I recently heard a nice summary of some of the historical origins of Halloween, mm-hmm. and they mentioned, and now I've forgotten how to, Samhain, but that's not how it's pronounced.
Samhain.
Of course, Dia de los Muertos and other kind of cultural rituals that take place in the fall. And it makes sense. I mean, things are changing. The light is changing. The world seems to be changing, becoming a different place. And supposedly, that's when things become liminal, which is a nice word. You know, out there, the veil between this world and the next gets thinner and thinner, and the ancestors come and visit. And, I mean, that's a sort of major strain, and it must be, I mean, it's Celtic, and it's also in the new world. Do you know much about the traditional indigenous origins of Dia de los Muertos?
Well, actually, that's an adaptation from Spanish missionaries.
Yeah, but wasn't there something that the indigenous people did before that they, or am I mixing it up with something else?
Yeah, it was a combination of things that happened, and so some of the things that we see on Dia de los Muertos are adaptations or kind of a mixture of cultures.
Yeah. Well, the Catholics are good at kind of.
Well, you know, we talk about Samhain and Halloween and, you know, its relationship to what we now call like All Saints Day. And, you know, in the very early Catholic Church, or the church that was growing, they started adapting to pagan festivals.
Yeah.
And to sort of bring in and entice people to come in and join the church. So a lot of the All Saints Day, you know, falls on days like Samhain.
Yeah. And so the celebrations fit. But the thing that's kind of nagging at me after listening to that history and remembering all of that stuff, and at the same time, I'm kind of Halloween is everywhere, and it's, you know, people have mock corpses in their yards and stuff like that, and it kind of puts me off. I don't know.
I mean, it's a lot of it's because it's been marketed and commercialized.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, you know, oh, you know, let's outdo the neighbors, let's decorate and put like gravestones and all these things, you know.
Yeah. Everywhere.
Yeah. And then the little ghouls knocking at your doors and stuff
like
that.
Yeah, well, I hope we have, I don't know, our neighborhood used to have a lot of kids, but I think they've all grown up and moved away, so I'm hoping.
Well, my neighborhood, we're out in the country, and generally what they do is they have like
you'd have to be brave to go all the way out to your house.
Well, yeah. Well, but they have, at the local church, they have a thing, you know, where they, trunk or treat or something like that.
Yeah, but what I was getting at was that in this commercialized Halloween, there's a lot of emphasis on real horror and blood and gore and grisly sorts of things, like there were in the kind of, and that's, terror was not traditionally a part of those cultural, of those fall celebrations when the dead are supposed to come back. I mean, the Dia de los Muertos is not supposed to be scary, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, it's a day of visiting with relatives who have passed.
Yeah, and you go out to the graveyard and you take Abuelo some of the stuff that he liked, and
you
sit there and
make a little offer, a little altar at home, and make your ofrendas.
Yeah, so
burn some candles.
So why the terror? Why do we like to be scared? I mean, that's
I had mentioned before that back in the 80s, Stephen King wrote, as far as I know, his only nonfiction book. It's called Danse Macabre, and the book is really good because he talks about the influences on his horror influences growing up and how it's reflected in his writings. But it also is a really good treatise on how horror, or how society has had, what effect it's had on the genre. I think, you know, as things change, and you know, one of the examples he gave was during the Cold War when we were growing up. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a lot more calming to think about horror movies than think about the possibility of being annihilated by an atomic bomb. And you know, so people leaned into the genre as a means of escape from the real terror, you know, in our world.
You could, if you got really psychological, argue that there's some kind of catharsis. Okay, I will have my terror over here in this fantasy realm instead of having my real terror of, you know, hiding under my desk at school for the atomic attack, which is what I don't know. I did that as a kid. I don't know if you did.
Well, yeah, we had those drills too. And I grew up in San Antonio, four Air Force bases and Army base headquarters. We were prime targets. We knew.
Yeah.
And when those air raid sirens went off, we all scrambled.
Yeah. Can you think of, are there other reasons why people like horror? Do you think it's, some people think it's, you know, you feel relieved that it's not you that this is happening to?
Yeah, there is that, and like I said, a catharsis. You know, some people have pent-up anxieties that maybe are expressed through, or they can relate to in the genre in some fashion. And again, as an escape, it's a whole different world, just like some people escape into, Lord of the Rings and you know, those things.
But why do you want to escape into being scared? Well, as we said, maybe it's a catharsis.
I don't know. Well, being scared does serve there's some psychological benefit in that. I mean, obviously the fight or flight, and but some people like to live on that edge, like that adrenaline rush. So they spend a lot of, and they adapt lifestyle. Look at goth kids. I mean.
Yeah, partly a fad and partly more, I think. We could listen to a story, if you like, this recording that I got last year from the mysterious Hieronymus Chilton.
Oh, my good friend Hieronymus, yes.
Yes, would you care to tell, you know, so I know a little about Hieronymus.
Well, you know, Hieronymus, he's kind of a weird little guy, I mean, but he's very knowledgeable in the genre.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I had talked about it, and he actually considered doing a show for the radio station.
Oh.
I'm still working on it and seeing if I can talk him into it, but anyway, he was kind enough to record this story for us.
Yeah.
And And the name of the story is There Are No Monsters on Rancho Buenavista.
Right. Let's...
Oh, and by the way, and the stories come from, I forgot what magazine it was, I mean, but you can Google, like, horror stories or something and find all these wonderful sources for stories. And
oh, oh so, yeah. Yeah, there's all kinds of, you know, when we started thinking about doing this, and this is a sort of a reprise of last year when we had some people coming in and reading different stories live and all, and so we were looking for stories. It's hard to find something short, actually.
Well, this is pretty short.
Yeah, this one is, but it's, you know, if you're looking for a scary story, Poe tends to go on, for example.
Yes.
All right. So this is Hieronymus Chilbone and There Are No Monsters on Rancho Buena Vista.
Greetings. This is Professor Hieronymus Chilbone coming to you at the request of my good friend, Miss Lader, who's asked me to share with you one of my favorite stories. This one is short, very short, but to the point. Tonight's story comes from Nightmare Magazine, published in June of 2022, issue number 117. Written by a young lady named Isabel Cañas. There are no monsters on Rancho Buena Vista. The young author states, in folk tales of Mexico, compiled by Américo Paredes, one of the founding fathers of Chicano studies in the U.S., I read a story about a man who discovered that his wife was a monster. My kind of story. Any night the man was away, the wife stripped away her skin and flew through the air as a skeleton, terrorizing the people of the town and stealing infants to eat. To defeat her, the man poured salt on her abandoned skin, thus killing her and saving the town. I thought about who was the true monster of the story, then took the story's skin and turned it inside out, so to speak. Rosario was not the prettiest young woman on Rancho Buena Vista, nor even the prettiest of her sisters. She was too aloof, too dreamy to be useful in a hard-working home. But that did not change the fact that her suitor, Beto, Antonio's cousin, was the most envied man. See, Rosario had secrets. Secrets have a way of drawing moth to flame, and Rosario's lit her like a lamp. Antonio worked himself sick watching the lovers. His was the kind of envy that gorged itself on shattering things. Convinced he could ruin Beto if he proved Rosario's glow came from the attentions of another man, he watched Rosario as a coyote stalks the chicken coop. Rosario began covering her hair and her face, darting skittish across shaded courtyards, even crossing the rancho bat-like with unpredictable looping routes, but Antonio was always watching. The moon was waxed. Rosario's temper waned. That night, Antonio lay on the cool banks of the creek. The moon was lopsided, drunk on its own light. It perfectly illuminated Rosario emerging from the oaks in her pale nightdress, dried leaves crackling under her bare feet. Imagine how victory flushed Antonio. He would catch Rosario in the act and crow to Beto come morning. Beto would be crushed and Rosario's eyes found him in the dark. Maybe she waved at him. She reached for her nightdress and slipped it over her head. Antonio's heart stopped. Then Rosario reached for her throat, sank her fingers into the skin and pulled. Her flesh split between her breast and down her belly, up her neck, over her face. It kept splitting, revealing the web of dark veins under wet organs, the wink of something bright. The skin of her face fissured and peeled away, taking lips, taking nose, taking eyelids and lashes and eyes, her long, heavy mane of dark hair leading her skins fall to the grass. A silver skeleton stood before Antonio. It stepped toward him. Antonio thrust himself to his feet and fled across the creek, soaking his boots, blood pulsing in his temples, and eyes so wide he feared they might pop out like Rosario's had. His cousins were roused by his screams that there was a monster on the rancho. "It's Rosario," he howled, inconsolable as dawn broke and thickened. She would steal babies and breathe curses on their sleeping women unless they found salt. They needed salt, more salt than anyone had imagined was possible. Barrels of it to pour on the monster's skin and separate her from it. Everyone says Antonio would have become the town crazy if he ever got the chance. But as he raved, a soft foam formed at his mouth. As he cried, "Salt! Salt! Salt!" the foam thickened. Globs of salt dropped from his lips to his boots. His spittle turned to salt. Then his tongue. Then his throat. His skin. His guts. A statue of salt stood in the pale sunrise, a pillar, until a breeze from the east lifted it, and it crumbled gently to the earth. Fíjense, there was no saving him, Beto said to the cousins later. They clicked their tongues, a circle of funereal black around the salt lick. They would have to check the cattle dogs for rabies, for naturally there were no monsters on Rancho Buenavista. From where they stood, they could see the Casa Mayor of the rancho, where Rosario sat demurely on the patio with her sisters, needlework gilded by quiet mourning. She lifted her head, smiled coyly at the oaks by the creek, and returned to her stitches.
Boy, that Rosario. Some kind of woman, eh? Well, my friends, if you've enjoyed this story, please, please join me, Professor Hieronymus Chilbone, with Creepy Night Stories coming soon. Stay tuned to this radio station.
Oh, well, that once... That, yeah. That makes me regret that Hieronymus...
I'm still working on him.
Decided not to do it. I mean, maybe if we can make him invisible when he comes in here?
I think he wouldn't mind coming in or doing like a specials every now and then or something.
Yeah, we could do that.
But I think he said that doing it on like a regular weekly or whatever, it was just too much. But
yeah, I mean, it's hard to crawl out of his crypt or wherever he lives, you know.
Yeah, you've never seen his crypt, but yeah, right. I agree. He doesn't come out very often.
Yes. So we are... You are on Bookmarked on a Halloween special, and we are talking with Uncle Gene, about reading stories and talking about scary stuff and generally enjoying ourselves. We hope you are enjoying yourself as well.
Did you watch monster movies when you were growing up?
No, I didn't. I wasn't big on horror. There are a few horror movies that I really like.
Like what?
Rosemary's Baby and the other one, I can't think of it. It's the very first zombie movie. And everybody in the town...
Night of the Living Dead.
Night of the Living Dead, yeah. The old black and white one.
The original, right.
Yes. That I liked. And I was kind of into vampires for a while. I read Anne Rice and stuff. But I've gotten, I don't know, gotten over that somehow.
Well, you know, the old monster classics, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, The Invisible Man, mm-hmm. Creature from the Black Lagoon, The Mummy. Oh, mm-hmm. Gosh, there was a whole bunch of mummy movies. Those were the monsters I grew up with.
Yeah, yeah. I've read a lot of horror, actually. I mean, I read Dracula, the whole thing, and Frankenstein, which is really... really remarkable when you think that it was written by a teenage Mary Shelley.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that too. All these horror genre written by these people, weren't they like drug addled or something when they were? No, I mean there was you know, drug use, but I mean,
yeah, there was, you know, there was a lot of.
I mean, can I think about like Poe? I mean,
yeah,
I mean, he's got some really dark stuff. And
yeah.
Of course, he was one of my favorites. Of course, Stephen King was too. So
yeah, well, we have a Poe story that we can do if we have time. I think right now we will take a station break, and then I'd like to read a poem, a Robert Frost poem. You don't think of Robert Frost as horror, but you never know.
I never thought of Robert Frost as poem. It's horror.
Okay.
Every Sunday afternoon from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. here on KZSM.org, Roots and Branches takes you down the highways, byways, side streets and back alleys of music. Join me, Tony Wilson, your host and guide on this weekly journey through the wonderful world of music from Texas and beyond. All you have to do is log on and listen. It's just that easy.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
All right, welcome back to our bookmarked Halloween special, where we are reading and playing recorded Halloween stories with my guest El Tio, Uncle Gene. And this is, you were just telling, this is a poem by Robert Frost that was written in 1922. And I know you were just telling me that
I never would have considered Robert Frost as writing in this genre.
Yeah, well, he does a number of long narrative poems. I don't know if you've ever read any of them, but yeah, you have. Yeah, read
I did
some.
A paper on Robert Frost on the whole thing about, what is it, depression and the ideation of suicide, especially in, as reflected in the poem "Stopping on
Stopping by Woods and Snowy Evening."
Right.
Yeah, yeah, and we don't really know that. We don't really know that those dark, deep woods mean death, but
if you read a lot about his background, he lost kids were dying and
yeah.
all sorts of things. So
yeah,
anyway,
but he did do some of these long narrative poems in blank verse, and how he came up with this one, I just wanted to get into the poem and didn't want to do too much research, although I learned a little bit about it, so. I think we'll read it, and then we can talk about it some more. It's got actually three different voices. You get to do two of them.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
You do the mother, and I do the rest of them.
Yeah. All right.
All right, ready?
Yeah.
I stay the night for shelter at a farm behind the mountain with the mother and son. Two old believers. They did all the talking.
Folks think a witch who has familiar spirits she could call up to pass a winter evening, but won't. Should be burned at the stake or something. Summoning spirits isn't button. Who's got the button? I would have them know.
Mother can make a common table rear and kick the two legs in an army mule.
And when I've done it, what good have I done? Rather than tip a table for you, let me tell you what Rala the Sioux Control once told me. He said the dead had souls, but when I asked him, how could that be? I thought the dead were souls. He broke my trance. Don't that make you suspicious that there's something the dead are keeping back? Yes, there's something the dead are keeping back.
You wouldn't want to tell him what we have up attic, Mother.
Bones, a skeleton.
But the headboard of Mother's bed is pushed against the attic door. The door is nailed. It's harmless. Mother hears it in the night. halting perplexed behind the barrier of door and headboard, where it wants to get his back into the cellar where it came from.
We'll never let them, will we, son? We'll never!
It left the cellar 40 years ago and carried itself like a pile of dishes up one flight from the cellar to the kitchen, another from the kitchen to the bedroom, another from the bedroom to the attic, right past both father and mother, and neither stopped it. Father had gone upstairs. Mother was downstairs. I was a baby. I don't know where I was.
The only fault my husband found with me, I went to sleep before I went to bed. Might just as well be ice, especially in the winter, when the bed might just as well be ice and the clothes snow. The night the bones came up the cellar stairs, Toffle had gone to bed alone and left me, but left an open door to cool the room off so as to sort of turn me out of it. I was just coming to myself enough to wonder where the cold was coming from when I heard Toffle upstairs in the bedroom and thought I heard him downstairs in the cellar. The board we had laid down to walk dry shod on when there was water in the cellar in the spring struck the hard cellar bottom. And then someone began the stairs, 2 footsteps for each step, the way a man with one leg and a crutch or a little child comes up. It wasn't Toffle. It wasn't anybody who could be there. The bulkhead double doors were double locked and swollen tight and buried under snow. The cellar windows were banked up with sawdust and swollen tight and buried under snow. It was the bones. I knew them, and good reason. My first impulse was to get to the knob and hold the door. But the bones didn't try the door. They halted helpless on the landing, waiting for things to happen in their favor. The faintest restless rushing ran all through them. I never could have done the thing I did if the wish hadn't been too strong in me to see how they were mounted for this walk. I had a vision of them put together, not like a man, but like a chandelier. So suddenly I flung the door wide on him. A moment he stood balancing with emotion and all but lost himself. A tongue of fire flashed out and licked along his upper teeth. Smoke rolled inside the sockets of his eyes. Then he came at me with one hand outstretched, the way he did in life once. But this time I struck the hand off brittle on the floor and fell back from him on the floor myself. The finger pieces slid in all directions. Where did I see one of those pieces lately? Hand me my button box. It must be there. I sat up on the floor and shouted, Toffle, it's coming up to you. It had its choice of the door to the cellar or the hall. It took the hall door for the novelty and set off briskly for so slow a thing. Still going every which way in the joints, though, so it looked like lightning or a scribble from the slap I had just now given its hand. I listened till it almost climbed the stairs from the hall to the only finished bedroom. Before I got up to do anything, then ran and shouted, Shut the bedroom door, Toffle, for my sake. Company, he said, don't make me get up. I'm too warm in bed. So lying forward weakly on the handrail, I pushed myself upstairs. And in the light, the kitchen had been dark. I had to own I could see nothing. Toffle, I don't see it. It's in the room with us, though. It's the bones. What bones? The cellar bones out of the grave. That made him throw his bare legs out of bed and sit up by me and take hold of me. I wanted to put out the light and see if I could see it, or else mow the room with our arms at the level of our knees and bring the chalk pile down. I'll tell you what, it's looking for another door to try. The uncommonly deep snow has made him think of his old song, The Wild Colonial Boy. He always used to sing along the tote road. He's after an open door to get outdoors. Let's trap him with an open door up attic. Toffle agreed to that, and sure enough, almost the moment he was given an opening, the steps began to climb the attic stairs. I heard them. Toffle didn't seem to hear them. Quick, I slammed the door and held the knob. Toffle, get nails. I made him nail the door shut and push the headboard of the bed against it. Then we asked if there was anything up attic we'd ever want again. The attic was less to us than the cellar. If the bones liked the attic, let them have it. Let them stay in the attic. When they sometimes come down the stairs at night and stand perplexed behind the door and headboard of the bed, brushing their chalky skull with chalky fingers, with sounds like the dry rattling of a shutter. That's when I sit up in the dark to say, to no one anymore since Toffle died, let them stay in the attic since they went there. I promised Toffle to be cruel to them for helping them be cruel once to him.
We think they had a grave down in the cellar.
We know they had a grave down in the cellar.
We never could find out whose bones they were.
Yes, we could too, son. Tell the truth for once. They were a man's his father killed for me. I mean, a man he killed instead of me. The least I could do was help dig their grave. We were about it one night in the cellar. Son knows the story, but 'twas not for him to tell the truth. Suppose the time has come. Son looks surprised to see me end a lie we'd kept all these years between ourselves so as to have it ready for outsiders. But tonight I don't care enough to lie. I don't remember why I ever cared. Toffle, if he were here, I don't believe, could tell you why he ever cared himself.
She hadn't found the finger bones she wanted among the buttons poured out in her lap. I verified the name next morning. Toffle. The rural letterbox said Toffle Legway.
Yeah. I like that. What do you think is good? Well, I love the last two lines because why is he doing that? Why does the guy who's supposedly been listening to all that stuff go out and look at the name on the letterbox?
Well, didn't he verify whose bones they were?
No, he doesn't know whose bones they were. They aren't. Toffle's her husband. They aren't her husband's. But he verifies the name. It's the only thing he can verify in all this crazy stuff, you know. It's a strange name. I looked at some sources on this just briefly, and it's actually supposedly a corruption of a French-Canadian name. Mm. The guy's name is Théophile Lajoie.
Okay.
And it becomes translated into Toffle Lajoie in the way that New Englanders do. But why does she tell the story after all those years?
Well, who's she telling the story to?
She's telling the story to the narrator, right?
Okay.
Who is, I don't know, Robert Frost. He's a stranger, I suppose. You know, he says he's, what does he say? He says he's taken shelter for the night at a farmhouse. So we assume that he's just a traveler who knocks on their door and says, you know, it's snowing and I'm... Mm-hmm. I'm
and they gave him shelter for the night, and they regale him with the story of the bones.
Yes. And why did, you know, just to scare him?
I don't know. Maybe that's their form of entertainment. telling scary stories to strangers, you know,
you wonder
stranded
about
in the night.
it seems possible, and we don't, and she, I love the way she, in that one sentence, she confesses, because first she says, a man, his father killed for me, and then she says, instead of me, and then you realize that this was what this was. I even wonder about the son, who was a baby.
Why? What about it?
What about the bones? Couldn't they be his father?
You know, I suppose they could. I mean, if you started looking at it that way, I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities.
Well, I can't help looking at it that way. I don't know, just because I suppose I like the voice of the old woman and the fact that she, you know, sometimes people do confide in strangers, you know. Have you ever done that or ever had somebody do that to you?
Oh, it happens to me all the time.
Yeah, you know, just...
I must have some kind of face or something that people say, hey, I can tell you all my deepest, darkest secrets.
Yeah. Well, you were the right choice to read the narrator then, since these folks, or the mother anyway, tells her deepest, darkest secrets. We have a little more time before our next break. Do you want to listen to something, or do you want to read one of the little? We collected some very short, scary stories from a Reddit website,
right,
that has a whole bunch of them, and it looks like a. I wish I could give you details, and some of them I couldn't find out who wrote them.
Well, you know, that's a good question, because interestingly, well, you know, I think a lot of these come in like on a TikTok or some sort of app. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think as I was looking through them, there you could see at the very top, you know, like some kind of a identification.
Yeah, yeah, like one.
Someone's handle or something.
The one I'm thinking of reading is Oshasha, which I don't think is the person's name.
No, probably her TikTok or whatever handle.
Yeah, and I guess people just post the stories and then they comment on each other's stories and all that. But if you're looking for scary shorts, and I just found it putting in scary short stories.
So, oh yeah, there's so many sources.
Yeah,
but I like going for the longer ones in the magazines.
Yeah,
because oftentimes they'll also include things, you know, like the classics, Ray Bradbury and mm-hmm. H.P. Lovecraft, Poe, and
yeah, yeah. Well, those are but they're mostly too long for radio, unfortunately.
Unless you're doing a radio show.
Yeah.
You know, radio theater or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I, and maybe we'll do. Speaking of that, should we do a Christmas Carol? Speaking of ghost again this year.
Hey, that's not a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, we did it last year. You got to be Scrooge.
I'm always Scrooge.
Yeah. No, you're not. Anyway, if you want to read I'm a Little Mama?
Yeah, that you know, I picked this one because it was kind of, well, some of the stories I was reading on Reddit were kind of interesting until at the very end, where the person who was telling the story apparently died.
Mm-hmm.
Those don't make sense to me. I mean, if they died, how are they telling the story that of what happened?
Yeah.
So I didn't want any of those. But this one was kind of interesting because, well, you'll see the ending. My uncle used to, the story is called Omelette O Mama, and it comes from Scary Short Stories.
And it looks like it was written by somebody named John Paul Edwards, but I'm not sure.
I think so.
Okay.
My uncle used to tell me that my mother was the devil. Then he'd reassure me he didn't really think she was the devil. It was just his way of sympathizing with my predicament. Mother hated my uncle. Said he was a messed up outcast of society, that he was a terrible influence. She banned me from seeing him and even got a restraining order. Every night, she came home late, drunk. She'd stumble through the door, sometimes with a strange second voice that I didn't recognize. In our house, there was lots of shouting, slamming doors, screaming. I never knew what to expect, except that something bad was going to happen. As I grew up, I began to actually suspect she was the devil. I started reading religious texts when I was about 11. I was doing research, trying to find answers to the bottomless well of anxiety I felt within. I remember the night I performed an exorcism on her. She was sleeping, and I snuck into her bedroom in my pajamas, carrying a cup of holy water that I had taken from the local church. Terrified of waking her up, I dabbed my fingers into the water and gently caressed her weathered forehead. I whispered a prayer, in which I poured all the love I had left to give. Please make her better, God. I love my mom. But I think it was too late, even for God, because things only got worse and worse. I was living inside fear every day, the worst kind of despair imaginable. I couldn't take it anymore. The constant abuse, the strangers, the hanging by a thin thread. I didn't want to harm myself any longer. If she was evil, if she was in fact Satan, I had to take it upon myself to kill her and end this reign of darkness. I needed to do it in a way where she couldn't fight back, or I knew she'd kill me first. I borrowed a hammer from someone and waited until she was sleeping again. It was a very practical thing I was doing, but I had no idea what to expect. I was terrified. I crept into her room, and I straddled her sleeping body. Then I bent my arms and swung the hammer over my head. It was like cracking an egg. Afterwards, I found myself in court, charged with murder. The judge said I was a delusional maniac who needed to be locked away for the safety of society. Even if she wasn't really the devil, what difference would it have made to me?
Oh, I love that ending.
Yeah, isn't that cool? I mean, just
what difference would it have made? And is he crazy or just, abused or?
Well, from the sounds of it, I mean, it was a very hostile environment for him. And either way, whether he was crazy or he needed to be liberated from this
person.
Untenable situation.
Yeah.
You know, he did something.
Yeah.
Maybe not the best action, but.
No. The egg image is terrifying. It's really
scary.
Yeah,
but his attitude, too. So what difference would it make, whether she was Satan or not? I mean.
Well, he's.
That's what caught me about this whole story.
Yeah, I like that. And it isn't just you find out that he's dead or something. He was. The judge said he was a. So I guess he's locked away for the safety of society, for all we know.
Well, yeah. Apparently that's. But he's okay with that.
Yeah.
I mean,
I guess so.
He did what he had to do.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you for reading that. I guess. Yeah. All right. We are up on another break.
KZSM.org would like to thank the following businesses, organizations, and individuals for underwriting and supporting our broadcasting and 24/7 live streaming programming. Blue Sky Mortgage, Daydream Modeling, Down to Earth Barbecue Sauce, Divine Timing Productions, Fasci, The Hill Country Freethinkers, Modern Day Hemp, The Price Center, the San Marcos Arts Commission, Schmidt Fire and Safety Company, and the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. If you, your business, or your organization would like to promote and maintain true community radio in San Marcos and around the world, find the donate button on our webpage, kzsm.org, or email kzsmsanmarcos@gmail.com to underwrite our programming. And again, thank you.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
All right. Welcome back to Bookmark.
That guy sounds familiar.
What? Yeah. Welcome back to Bookmark on KZSM 104.1 LPFM and KZSM.org, where we're messing around, I guess, with horror stories recorded and read live. And my guest is El Tio Uncle Gene, whose dulcet tones you just... dulcet doesn't seem like they're quite the right word, resonant, okay.
Resonant,
okay.
Sonorous,
yeah.
Sonorous.
Yeah. And we're playing some things that we recorded last year on a Halloween special. So I think, if you're okay with it, I think I'd like to play, this is called Down by the Sea Near the Great Big Rock, and the writer is Joe Lansdale, who is a Texas writer. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. Joe Lansdale, yeah. Yeah, he does mysteries and stuff like that. I keep kind of trying to work up enough nerve to ask him to come on this show. but maybe not to talk about this particular story. But this is read by Kirk Fraley, who was for some time my producer and who's still, whose voice you, I actually just heard him reading, thank you, because he still does public service announcements for us just as well. So this is, see if this one scares you. This is Down by the Sea by the Great Big Rock.
Down by the Sea Near the Great Big Rock by Joe Lansdale. Down by the sea near the Great Big Rock, they made their camp and toasted marshmallows over a small, fine fire. The night was pleasantly chill and the sea spray cold. Laughing, talking, eating the gooey marshmallows, they had one swell time. Just them, the sand, the sea and the sky, and the Great Big Rock. The night before, they had driven down to the beach, to the camping area. And on their way, perhaps a mile from their destination, they had seen a meteor shower, or something of that nature. Bright lights in the heavens glowing momentarily seemed to burn red blisters across the ebony sky. Then it was dark again. No meteoric light, just the natural glow of the heavens, the stars, the dime-sized moon. They drove on and found an area of beach on which to camp. A stretch dominated by pale sands and big waves and the Great Big Rock. Tony and Murray watched the children eat their marshmallows and play their games, jumping and falling over the Great Big Rock, rolling in the cool sand. About midnight, when the kids were crashed out, they walked along the beach like fresh-found lovers, arm in arm, shoulder to shoulder, listening to the sea, watching the sky, speaking words of tenderness. "I love you so much," Murray told Tony, and she repeated the words and added, "and our family too." They walked in silence now. The feelings between them words enough. Sometimes Murray worried that they did not talk as much as all the marriage manuals suggested, that so much of what he had to say on the world and his work fell on the ears of others, and that she had so little to truly say to him. Then he would think, "What the hell? I know how I feel." Different messages, unseen, unheard, pass between us all the time, and they communicate in a fashion words cannot. He said some catchphrases, some pet thing between them, and Tony laughed and pulled him down on the sand. Out there between that shiny dime moon, they stripped and loved on the beach like young sweethearts, experiencing their first night together after a long expectation. It was nearly 2 a.m. when they returned to the camper, checked the children and found them sleeping comfortably as kittens full of milk. They went outside for a while and sat on the rock and smoked and said hardly a word. Perhaps a coo or a purr passed between them, but little more. Finally, they climbed inside the camper, zipped themselves into their sleeping bag and nuzzled together on the camper floor. Outside, the wind picked up and the sea waved in and out and a slight rain began to fall. Not long after, Murray awoke and looked at his wife in the crook of his arm. She lay there with her face in a grimace, her mouth opening and closing like a guppy, making an sound. A nightmare, perhaps. He stroked the hair from her face, ran his fingers lightly down her cheek and touched the hollow of her throat and thought, "What a nice place to carve out some fine white meat." "What in the hell is wrong with me?" Murray thought, and he rolled away from her out of the bag. He dressed, went outside and sat on the rock. With shaking hands on his knees, buttocks resting on the warmth of the stone, he brooded. Finally, he dismissed the possibility that such a thought had actually crossed his mind, smoked a cigarette, and went back to bed. He did not know that an hour later, Tony awoke, bent over him, and looked at his face as if it were something to squash. But finally, she shook it off and slept. The children tossed and turned. Little Roy squeezed his hands open, closed. His eyelids fluttered rapidly. Robin dreamed of striking matches. Morning came, and Murray found that all he could say was, "I had the oddest dream." Tony looked at him and said, "Me too." And that was all. Placing lawn chairs on the beach, they put their feet on the rock and watched the kids splash and play in the waves. Watched as Roy mocked the sounds of jazz music and made fins with his hands and chased Robin through the water as she scuttled backwards and screamed with false fear. Finally, they called the children from the water, ate a light lunch, and leaving the kids to their own devices, went in for a swim. The ocean stroked them like a mink-gloved hand, tossed them, caught them, massaged them gently. They washed together, laughing, kissing. They tore their lips from one another as on the beach they heard a scream. Roy had his fingers gripped about Robin's throat, held her back, bent over the rock, and was putting a knee in her chest. There seemed no play about it. Robin was turning blue. Tony and Murray waded for shore, and the ocean no longer felt kind. It grappled with them, held them, tripped them with wet, foamy fingers. It seemed an eternity before they reached the shore, yelling at Roy. Roy didn't stop. Robin flopped like a dying fish. Murray grabbed the boy by the hair and pulled him back. And for a moment, as the child turned, he looked at his father with cold eyes that did not seem his, but looked instead as cold and firm as the great big rock. Murray slapped him so hard Roy spun and went down, stayed there on hands and knees panting. Murray went to Robin, who was already in Tony's arms, and on the child's throat were blue-black bands like thin, ugly snakes. Baby, are you okay? Tony asked over and over. Murray wheeled, strode back to the boy, and Tony was now yelling at him, crying, Murray, easy now. They were just playing and got out of hand. Roy was on his feet, and Murray gritted his teeth, so angry he could not believe it, slapped the child down. Murray, Tony yelled. She let go of the sobbing Robin and went to stay his arm, for he was already raising it for another strike. That's no way to teach him not to hit, not to fight. Murray turned to her, almost snarling, but then his face relaxed and he lowered his hand. Turning to the boy, feeling very criminal, Murray reached down to lift Roy by the shoulder, but Roy pulled away, darting for the camper. Roy, he yelled, and started after him. Tony grabbed his arm. Let him be, she said. He got carried away and he knows it. Let him mope it over. He'll be okay. Then softly, I've never known you to get so mad. I've never been so mad before, he said honestly. They walked back to Robin, who was smiling now. They all sat on the rock, and about 15 minutes later, Robin got up to go see about Roy. I'm going to go tell him it's okay, she said. He didn't mean it. She went inside the camper. She's sweet, Tony said. Yeah, Murray said, looking at the back of Tony's neck as she was watching Robin move away. He was thinking he was supposed to cook lunch today, make hamburgers, slice onions, big onions, cut thin with a freshly sharpened knife. He decided to go get it. I'll start lunch, he said flatly and stalked away. As he went, Tony noticed how soft the back of his skull looked. So much like an overripe melon. She followed him inside the camper. The next morning, after the authorities had carried off the bodies, taken the four of them out of the blood-stained, fire-gutted camper, one detective said to another, "Why does it happen? Why would someone kill a nice family like this? And in such horrible ways, set fire to it afterwards." The other detective sat on the huge rock and looked at his partner and said, "Kicks, maybe." That night, when the moon was high and bright, gleaming down like a big spotlight, the big rock, satiated, slowly spread its flippers out scuttled across the sand into the waves and began to swim towards the open sea. The fish that swam near it began to fight.
As the sound of the waves die away, you... Wow. Yeah. That's pretty good. Down by the Sea, Near the Great Big Rock by Joe Lansdale. You're looking puzzled.
No, that was kind of an interesting twist on the rock.
Yeah. Well, remember they saw a meteor shower, right?
Oh, that's right.
So the rock actually came from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this
from beyond.
From beyond. This is one of those beyond stories. Okay, I got a 3.5 minute beyond story. You want?
Go for it.
These are, again, you are listening to a special Halloween edition of Bookmarked, where we're talking with El Tio and reading and listening to some scary stories. And this one is, again, from a little collection on Reddit. But it's more of the alien variety.
Mm.
I woke up with a bad headache, feeling disoriented. Before I could comprehend what was happening, I felt a kick. Looking down, I saw a huge belly. What was going on? I frantically searched room to room with a blank memory. When I finally saw myself in a mirror, I was shocked. I was pregnant in my second trimester. The last thing I remembered was going on a trip with my family. Suddenly, a charming man entered. I felt a shiver run down my spine. "Honey, are you all right?" he whispered. I cried, "Who am I? Who are you? Why are you here?" He looked sad, calming me down. "I'm your husband." But I'd never been married. As he spoke, I noticed his pupils seemed slightly off. They appeared to shift, like the shadows on a moonlit night. He gave me water to calm down, and my mind went blank. As I sipped the water, his gaze lingered on me, making my skin prickle. His smile seemed to hide something. When I woke, the room was dimly lit. He sat beside me, holding my hand. "How long have I been asleep?" I asked, trying to clear the fog. "A few hours," he replied, smiling. "You needed it." His fingers felt cold, almost scaly. "Tell me about our marriage," I demanded. Desperate for clarity, I pressed further. "Where is my family? Why don't I remember anything?" His gaze darkened momentarily, and I felt a cold chill. "You're safe here," he said, but his voice seemed to echo strangely, as if it came from somewhere deep within. Suddenly, a kick jolted me again, sharper, as if urging me to pay attention. I looked up at him, but he appeared more tense now, his jaw clenched. He hesitated before speaking. "We met 5 years ago, fell deeply in love, and married a year later in a small ceremony." I was searching for deceit. His eyes seemed to flash with an eerie light. "Where are the pictures?" I pressed. He sighed. "We lost them in a move, but I have something else." He handed me a small box containing a beautiful diamond ring. "This was your wedding ring," he said, eyes locked on mine. As I held the ring, a memory flashed, him slipping it onto my finger, his eyes gleaming with an otherworldly intensity. "Mine," he whispered, his breath cold against my ear. His face began to warp and distort, revealing scaly purple skin beneath. His eyes turned black, and vertical pupils sliced through the darkness. "You're carrying our hybrid," he hissed, his voice no longer human. I stumbled backward, horror-stricken. The room filled with an eerie glow, and I saw his true form, an alien creature, its body twisted and grotesque. "The pregnancy will complete our species' evolution," it growled. I screamed, but my voice was drowned out by the sound of ships descending from the sky. The alien's face contorted into a cruel smile. "Welcome to the colony, mate." Did you like that one?
Yeah, that was...
That's the... More of those... More, again, of the alien threat sort of thing.
You like those alien stories, huh?
Well, not necessarily. They there's a whole discussion that we could have about threatening alien movies versus nice alien movies like E.T. or Starman, in which
The Earth Stood Still.
Yeah, in which the aliens come with no intention, but then are oppressed and tormented by the people who are here. But that's a whole another story, and it's 5 o'clock. So, all right. So, thank you very much, El Tio, Uncle Gene, for coming and talking and reading about horror with me. And as always, thank you for listening.